Namaste, Jai Shri Krishna, everyone. So, my essay in this book deals with Romila Thapar. Romila Thapar, as you know, is a very influential historian. She is like the godmother of all the Marxist historians. So I'll start. So I'm not introducing her because I assume that most people know about her. So these are the issues examined in my essay. So I try to critically examine Romila Thapar's views on the Islamic period of Indian history, then her theories related to Hindu Dharma and her views on sacred Hindu texts like Ramayana and Mahabharata. And if time permits, I will discuss her theories on India and, you know, Hindu nationalism. So my inspiration for this essay is a video lecture series which Rajivji had given 2 years back, in which he had discussed, you know, critically examined Romila Thapar's methodology and called it a colonized approach to history. So my essay is largely based on what Rajivji had already said. So let's now begin. Romila Thapar on the Islamic period of Indian history. So her theory regarding the cause of invasions. So Romila Thapar, she says that, you know, most of the medieval rulers of foreign rulers of India, the Islamic invaders, they were not actually motivated by religious considerations. And all their actions, you know, regarding the non-Muslims of this country were usually prompted by economic considerations, or these were the things. So they were very greedy, that's why they attacked India. So this is a very prominent example, Somnath Temple attack. And she has written a book also, a complete book, you know, 200-page book on Somnath. So she comes up with theories like, you know, Mahmud's raid on the Somnath and other temples were due to economic motives. That's the general pattern the Marxist historians follow. They try to see it everything through class struggle, you know, economic class struggle. So she says that his greed for gold was insatiable. So that is why he attacked, you know, some kind of psychoanalysis she has done of Mahmud Ghazni. So now then she says that, you know, this is one thing. First of all, she says that, you know, he was very greedy. That is why he attacked Somnath Temple. Then next, she says that, you know, it was a very trivial matter. Hindus, you know, did not even remember it, you know, and this some Hindu Raja, he gave a grant also to some Arab trader. So it was a very trivial matter. It was not a big deal. So, you know, Hindus are just making a big deal out of it. It doesn't matter at all. And then she, you know, comes up, she tries to suggest that, you know, maybe the attack even never happened at all. I mean, you know, Hindus just made it up. So these are the three things she says in her book, Somnath, on Somnath Temple attack. Now I will just quote a few, you know, interesting quotations by her. So she says the raid of Mahmud could not have been forgotten 200 years after the event if it had been as traumatic as it is currently said to be. And then she says, you know, she's saying, you know, it's, you know, it might not have happened. So this is, you know, she's trying to suggest this thing, and she's very clever. She never she never says anything directly. She will give you hints like these, you know, and try to, you know, insinuate that this might be the case, that this, so she is not based on facts. She will just, you know, give you hints. You know, this might could be the case, this could be the case, and that's it. Then she says that no mention is made of Mahmud's attack on the Somnath temple, which is strange, given the statement that the temple had deteriorated and needed renovation. This is puzzling for her. She says this is puzzling, as there are occasional references to the breaking of temples. Or was the looting of temple not such an extraordinary event, given that some Hindu rulers also attacked temples of those they had conquered? And she, I mean, she's trying to suggest that, you know, it was very common. Hindu kings also used to do that. So Mahmud was just, you know, doing the same thing. It was not something, you know, different. Yeah, so this is her from her book. I have quoted. Now, let us come to the facts. Now, in this, text, Ibn al-Athir, he's a Muslim historian of 1230 CE, so quite 100 years after Mahmud's raid. So he says then when Yamin-ud-Dawla, how he addresses Sultan Mahmud, was gaining victories and demolishing temples in India, the Hindus said that Somnath was displeased with these idols and that if it had been satisfied with them, no one could have destroyed or injured them. When Yamin-ud-Dawla heard this, he resolved upon making a campaign to destroy this idol. So basically, you know, Mahmud attacked, you know, because he was told that, you know, Shivji ki jo ye Somnath Mandir hai, it's very powerful, you know. So he said, no, my God is more powerful, that is why I'll destroy. I'll show it to you by destroying this temple. So this was the reason, you know, it's mentioned in this text by a Muslim historian of that period. So Romila Thapar, she says that, you know, there are no contemporaneous account of Mahmud's attack, but there are, I mean, that is not factual. So like this poet Dhanpal in his Apabhramsh poem, which was the earlier version of Hindi, Apabhramsh, Satya Puriya Shri Mahavir Utsaha. So he states that Anhilwad, Sorat and Someshwar, so Someshwar was the earlier name of Somnath, were looted by Turks. So it's a 12th century text. Then in the 14th century Jain text, Vivid Tirth Kalpa, it's written that by Jina Prabhasuri, that looting of, he mentions looting of Gurjar country, which again means Gujarat, by Ghaznavi, Mahmud of Ghazni. So there are textual references, you know, in the Hindu and Jain texts that, you know, this Somnath temple was attacked. Then the second thing, she says that Hindu culture flourished, you know, during the Turkish and Mughal rule. So these are some of the quotations. Far from being victimized, Hindu culture flourished along with other cultures in these centuries. And she says that, you know, Madhava's Sarv Darshan Sangrahe and, you know, Samay Sundar's Arth Ratnavali and, you know, Shayan's, you know, Shayanacharya's, you know, commentary on the Vedas, it was written during the Muslim period. So she says that, see, Hindu culture was flourishing, you know, why you Hindus are, you know, making a fuss about it. So then she says the bhajans of Meera and Surdas and the poetry of Kabir and Tukaram, as well as the many renderings of Ramayan, were all composed in this period. So this is her argument that, you know, so many texts were being written, then, you know, what's the big deal? You know, there was nothing wrong with the Muslim invasion. And then she, you know, she says that, you know, during the medieval period, there was also an intermingling of cultures, you know, Hindu and Islamic culture. And, you know, the best known example, according to her, is Dhrupad. And it is regarded as one of the finest form of Hindustani classical music. So she says that Dhrupad was developed during the Muslim period. So that's the contribution of Muslim rule to Bharat. Now let's come to the facts. So Shayanacharya, which she mentions, so he was a Sanskrit scholar in the independent Hindu Vijayanagar kingdom. So I don't know why she is, you know, referring to Shayanacharya when, you know, she, you know, while talking about the contribution of Islamic rule to India. Then, you know, he wrote commentaries, you know, under the patronage of commentaries on Vedas, under the patronage of Vijayanagar kings Bukkavan and Harihar. So there is no point in, you know, in attributing what he has written to some, you know, Tughlaq or maybe Akbar, her favorite. Now, then she, again, Madhava, who wrote Sarv Darshan Sangrahe, so he was Shayanacharya's brother, and he was also based in the Vijayanagar kingdom. Then this Jain writer, Samay Sundar, he was, you know, he lived in Rajasthan, and he traveled in different areas, some Barmer and Jaisalmer, which were, you know, outside the Mughal control, actually. They were ruled by, you know, some Bharti rulers at that time. Now, regarding Surdas, so she says that, you know, Mirabai and Surdas also composed their poetry during the Mughal period. But, you know, there is a very interesting discussion in the Vaishnav Vartas, which are in Braj Bhasha. And, you know, in that Vartas, it's mentioned that Akbar, you know, met Surdas only once. And, you know, Akbar asked Surdas ji that, you know, what do you want me to do? And this was Surdas ji's reply: from now on, never again summon me and never try to meet me again. So, I mean, there is no point in attributing, you know, Braj Bhasha poetry, Sur Sagar, to Akbar. I mean, there was no relation at all. But still she, you know, says that, you know, it was a contribution of Mughal rulers, especially Akbar. And again, Mirabai, as we all know, she was, you know, based in Marwad and Mirta. And they were, you know, again, not under the control of Turkish rulers at that time. So 1498, she was born in 1498, and, you know, the rest of her period, it is before the Mughals invaded India, before, you know, Babur's invasion. So Mirta and Marwad were independent kingdoms at that time. So again, you know, there is no point in, you know, mentioning Mirabai while talking about, you know, some intermingling of Hindu and Islamic culture. Now let us come to Dhrupad. She says that, you know, Dhrupad was the contribution of Mughal rulers, But Dhrupad is a very ancient form of, you know, Hindustani classical music, and it is the successor of Prabandhagan, and it was between 11th and 13th century. It enjoyed great popularity, and you know, she never mentions about Raja Man Singh Tomar of Gwalior, who was the, you know, I think the most important person who should be mentioned when talking about Dhrupad, but not many people know about him. And the legendary musician Tansen, actually he was at the court of Raja Man Singh Tomar, and you know, when Akbar attacked Gwalior and captured it, then he took Tansen also with him. So Tansen was already an accomplished musician and a Dhrupad singer before the Mughal time. And then there were especially in the Vaishnava tradition, there are a lot of acharyas who have been famous for Dhrupad music. So I mentioned some names: Shril Jeev Goswami, Raghunath Das from the Gaudiya Vaishnav Sampradaya, and there was Swami Haridas also, who was the acharya of Tansen. So these were, and Vrindavan was a very prominent seat of Hindustani classical music even much before the Mughal or Turkish invasion. So there is no point in saying that Dhrupad was something which came up suddenly due to Akbar or some Mughal ruler. That's not factual at all. It's totally incorrect. Now let's come to the what Mughal rulers were actually doing. So contrary to Thapar's claims, the Muslim rulers, instead of patronizing Hindu scholarship in Sanskrit or other vernacular languages, they were patronizing Persian. So there is an interesting quote, Amir Khusro. I mean, I'm sure everyone knows about him, and he was a very important person because he was close to six successive sultans during the during the Turkish rule. And he, in one of his works, Nuh Sipir, written in 1318, he says that, Arabic is the knowledge of learning, Turkey is art, Persian is sweet, and all other languages are bad and worth nothing. So this is his opinion on other languages. So he likes only Turkey and Persian and Arabic. And he doesn't mention, Sanskrit or Avdi or Brajbhasha or, Apabhramsh. So, and then Akbar, Akbar is, generally he is mentioned again and again that, he was, during his time, a lot of fusion happened and, he was very tolerant, and all these things are mentioned about him. But, Akbar was the first Muslim ruler who formally institute a position of Malik-ush-Shuara. So it's a Persian term, and it means poet laureate at the court. And this was to be awarded only to a Persian poet only. So, and Akbar was patronizing Persian. I mean, there is no mention of Sanskrit as such. And then he also made Persian the official language of administration at all levels. And because of that, learning and knowledge and high culture began to be associated with Persian. So, if you speak Persian, you would understand very well. And if you are speaking Sanskrit or some Braj Bhasha, then you are some Gamar kind of person who doesn't know, some bumpkin. So, now let's come to Romila Thapar's views on Hinduism and Hindu epics. That's interesting, actually. So she has, coined these terms. I don't know what exactly, she has not clearly specified what does she mean by these terms. So she says Vedic Brahmanism, that's one term, and Puranic Hinduism. So she says, Vedic Brahmanism is the evil thing. In her view, it propagated the use of Sanskrit through elaborate rituals. Karmakandi, all these people were, Vedic, where they were, following Vedic Brahmanism. And then Vedic Brahmanism, when it infiltrated, it went and tried to digest all the other, indigenous cultures, then Puranic Hinduism emerged out of it. So Puranic Hinduism is a kind of compromise between Vedic Brahmanism and the local indigenous cultures of India, the tribal cultures, as she says. And Thapar believes that, deities like Shiv and Vishnu were earlier marginal. Koi inko janta bhi nahi tha, who are these Shiv and Vishnu? And then suddenly, because of this, process of assimilation, they became, prominent. And this thing happened, this transformation happened between the Gupta period and the first millennium CE. I've kept this thing in bold because these dates are very important. So before the Gupta period, no one knew about Shiv and Vishnu. According to her, they were just marginal. Some people in some remote corner might be worshipping them. But after that, suddenly, at the end of first millennium these became very prominent deities. So now let's come to the facts. Now, so Romila Thapar has this theory that, you know, if in the Vedas there are a large number of, you know, hymns dedicated to Indra, then it means that Indra must be the most, you know, prominent deity. So, you know, it's directly proportional to the number of hymns. The importance is directly proportional to the number of hymns. So maybe she has counted, you know, that, you know, the number of hymns for Indra are too many. So Indra is most important, and then Shiva and Vishnu, they are not that prominently featured in the Vedas. So they must be marginal, which is not correct actually as per the traditional way of looking at Vedas. But yeah, so this is what I mentioned. The larger the number of hymns to a deity in the Vedas does not necessarily imply that the deity is more important. Now, Taittiriya Aranyak of the Krishna Yajurveda, it says that, you know, and the Purush Sukta of the Rig Veda. So basically in Purush Sukta, Supreme Being, the Purush, is equated with Virat Purush, is equated with Vishnu. So it's not that, you know, these are not mentioned by, if it is equated with the Supreme Being, I mean, how important could it get? I mean, what exactly should we ask for, you know, to judge the importance of some deity? And then, you know, if you look into Shvetashvatar Upanishad, so it's all about, you know, it equates the ultimate highest reality with Rudra or Shiv. So it's not that these deities are mentioned, and they are mentioned very prominently. They are the ultimate reality if you look into the Vedic literature. And now these are the textual evidences. We also have numismatic and archaeological evidence to show that before the Gupta period, Shiv and Vishnu and Krishna, they were very prominent. So like, you know, even prior to the Gupta period, this Indo-Scythian ruler, Maus, I think it's a, you know, it's a distortion of Mahesh, who ruled because they called themselves Maheshwara. Maheshwara means worshippers of Mahesh, Shivji. So, you know, in 1st century BC, you know, he issued several coins. I will show the images also with Lord Shiva's image on them. And then in the Shak and Kushan rulers, they are very famous. You know, they issued a lot of gold coins with, you know, images of Shivji and Ma Parvati and Nandi. So there are so many coins from 1st century BC, from 2nd century BC. So, you know, saying that, you know, these deities became prominent after Gupta period or somewhere around, you know, from 480 to 1000 AD. So that's totally incorrect, not factual. And there is also a temple, you know, of Shunga period temple. So I have, you know, mentioned dates which these, you know, these historians use. I actually don't agree with these dates, but I've used them because I want to, you know, I'm doing a Purva Paksha, so I should use, you know, what she thinks. So I've used the dates which she uses. So these are not my dates. So we have, you know, during the Shunga period, there is currently a temple in Andhra, Parshurameshwar temple, and, you know, it has a huge Shivalingam, and it belongs to 1st century BC. So Shiv was worshipped, you know, and it could be even older. That this is the date suggested by her. So she is contradicting herself, you know, because, you know, she's saying that they became prominent only after, you know, first millennium. So these are the coins, you know, showing Shiva. And you can see Nandi also, and you can see the trident also. And these are the Kushan coins. Then, you know, this is the Gudimalam Shivalingam, which I'm talking about. And this is from 1st century BC. Then, you know, talking about Vishnu worship before the Gupta period. So I think most people would be aware of the Besnagar pillar in Vidisha, Madhya Pradesh. So, you know, it is basically, you know, some Bhagavat worshipper called Heliodorus. He was a Greek actually. And there, you know, there is a, at the Besnagar, they also excavated and they found the foundations of a Vishnu temple also. And that pillar is actually Garud Dhvaj, which was always, you know, near the Vishnu temple. And then there are, you know, torsos and idols of Lord Vishnu from 2nd century BC, which have been found. And there is also a coin by a Kushan ruler, a Niccolo seal by a Kushan ruler, Huvishk, and which was, you know, there was this British archaeologist, Alexander Cunningham. So, and that Niccolo seal shows God Vishnu holding his Gada, Chakra, you know, and other Shankh and Padma. So this is the Besnagar pillar belonging to the Shunga period. And this is the Niccolo seal. As you can see, you know, that wheel is actually Chakra, representation of Chakra, and you can see conch and shell also, if you look closely. And that person, you know, standing in submission is the Kushan ruler. So again, you know, these were prominent deities even before the Gupta period. So she's not factually correct when she says that, you know, their worship became prominent during after the first millennium CE. Then, you know, Varaha worship. So that's very interesting. She says that, you know, ye Varaha worship to Central India mein jo tribals the, they used to worship Varaha. And then, you know, Vedic Brahminism appropriated it and, you know, and made him an incarnation of Bhagwan Vishnu. And, you know, but again, this is, and this happened after 6th century CE. And it was a compromise between the tribal cults of Central India and the Puranic religion. But you again, you know, if you see Taittiriya Aranyak, you will find references to Varaha Avatar. And, you know, there are sculptures also, and there are images discovered, you know, Varaha holding Bhumi Devi. So, and which are, you know, these texts are thousands of years older than 6th century CE, as per her own estimates. So, you know, again, there is a contradiction in what she says. You know, she is saying that, you know, this became prominent only in 6th century CE, but there are references to Varaha, and not just minor references, you know, they are very prominently mentioned, and they are even, you know, considered avatar of Vishnu. So it was not something, you know, concocted later on by some, you know, evil Brahmins. Then, you know, she again claims that, you know, so there was this, you know, some goddess she has found, you know, Ardosho. So this goddess Ardosho, it was, you know, adopted as Shri or Lakshmi. So Lakshmi ki bhi hum puja nahi karte the. It was adopted by some foreign goddess Ardosho during the Kushan period of 1st and 2nd century CE. Yeah, so again, this claim is completely, you know, incorrect, because it's very popular. Shri Suktam is a very popular hymn in the Rig Veda. And, you know, Shri Suktam, it, you know, it's mentioned that, you know, it is the it's in the Rig Veda, and Rig Veda, as you know, is, you know, I mean, thousands of years older than 1st century CE. And even Shatpath Brahman, it mentions, you know, Lakshmi as the goddess of fortune and beauty. So there is no, this is not, again, factually incorrect. And we have archaeological evidences also. I will show Bharut Stupa, it's in Madhya Pradesh, and there is a medallion from a railing post, and it shows Gajalakshmi, two elephants, you know, holding pots in their trunks, and, you know, and they are showering goddess Lakshmi with gold coins. So this belongs to 2nd century BC. So this is incorrect to say that, you know, some Ardosho was the goddess, you know, actual goddess, and then the Hindus turned into Lakshmi in the 1st century CE. So this is the medallion from Bharut Stupa in Madhya Pradesh, and as you can see, in the middle is Ma Lakshmi, and, you know, you can see two elephants also. You know, so this is from, you know, this is earlier than 1st century CE. Then Thapar's claims on, you know, Shri Krishna. Actually, there is a lot of to, you know, talk about, but I want to keep it short because we are short of time. So, you know, she has this theory that, you know, Shri Ram and Shri Krishna worship started, you know, after the Muslim invasion. So Hindus wanted some, you know, some king, you know, whom they could say, oh yeah, we had a very nice, you know, warrior kind of king. So after that, you know, they took up Ramayana, and, you know, and, you know, they made Shri Ram and Shri Krishna prominent. Earlier, no one knew about them. And she also mentions that, you know, Ramayana itself was written later on. It was not the actual composition of Valmiki. She also says that it was copied by some Buddhist Jatak, you know, Dashrath Jatak. It was copied by Valmiki from Buddhist Dashrath Jatak. This is what she says. So again, you know, I will just talk about Shri Krishna. So Shri Krishna worship is very, very old. I mean, you know, even in Ashtadhyayi, Acharya Panini, he mentions about him. And according to her, Ashtadhyayi belongs to, again, 5th to 4th century BC. That is what she says is the date according to her. And, you know, so Ashtadhyayi mentions about, you know, Vasudev and Arjun. And they're mentioned together in connection for the derivation of words denoting their devotees. So, you know, Bhagwan and, you know, jo Bhakta hai. So during that, you know, they discuss about Vasudev and Arjun. And, you know, if there is any doubt, then, you know, if you read the commentary written by Maharishi Patanjali, in his Mahabhashya, he clearly states that Vasudev here refers to the worshipful one, the god. And then Bhagavat Vaishnavism was, you know, it was very prominent, you know, even in Afghanistan. There are, you know, there are coins issued, you know, with, I mean, showing Shri Krishna and Balram by this Indo-Greek king Agathocles in the 2nd century BC. So all her claims that, you know, there were no Hindu gods before before the Gupta period. Actually, her theory is that it was only during the Gupta period that Hinduism, as we see now, was constructed. Earlier, it was no such thing, no deities, nothing, no Hinduism, no Hindu nation. And she talks about Bharatvarsha also. She says, you know, there was no concept of India or nation or anything like that. It was just a geographical entity and there was no such thing as, you know, which is also not correct. So now Thapar's claims on bhakti sects. So she says that, you know, bhakti tradition actually was, you know, inspired by Buddhism and Jainism, which is quite, you know, quite funny because, you know, as I will show you how it is funny, but she says that, you know, it was inspired by Buddhism and Jainism. So again, you know, she's trying to create a drift between the, you know, various, you know, Buddhism, Jainism and Hinduism, the various, you know, different variations of Sanatan Dharma. So she says that Hindus adopted it from Buddhism and Jainism. And then she says that the feeling of human inadequacy that became an important facet of the bhakti devotional sects would have owed more to the Buddhist ancestry than to the Vedic. So this is her claim. And then she vaguely also tries to suggest that, you know, Sri Ramanujacharya of Vishishtadvaita school, he was inspired by Calvinist Christians because, you know, his whole theory of prapatti and all is actually, you know, what is practiced in Christianity. Now if we look into the Vedic hymns, so there are, you know, for example, in Mundak Upanishad, there is a mention of human inadequacy in the attainment of moksha. So Paramatma is not attained through mere rumination, nor through mere meditation, nor through much hearing. He is attainable by that individual whom this Paramatma chooses. The Supreme Self reveals his own form to such a one. So this is basically doctrine of prapatti. It is not very, you know, prominently, you know, told to everyone, but this concept is there if you look into Hindu texts. So it is not that, you know, it was adopted from Calvinist Christians. Now, regarding Buddhism, so in Buddhist philosophy, there is no permanent entity. There is this concept of Kshanikvada. In Kshanikvada, they say there is no permanent entity. So there is, everything is Kshanik. It keeps on changing every moment. So when I came on this stage, I was a different Anurag and now I'm a different Anurag. I'm a totally different person now. So there is no Jivatma because Jivatma has to be permanent, and there is no Paramatma because again it has to be permanent. And this is the doctrine followed by all the four philosophical schools of Buddhism. So when there is no Jivatma and there is no Paramatma, I don't understand how can there be a concept of bhakti, because bhakti is between Paramatma and Jivatma. But still she says that, you know, bhakti was copied by Hindus from Buddhism and Jainism. So which is, that is why I was saying it was very funny, you know, to see this. So again, you know, so again she says that, you know, this concept of moksha through anugraha, divine grace, I've used the word divine grace, but the Sanskrit term is anugraha. So she says that, you know, it was also copied from Christianity or Islam, or, you know, she has all kinds of theories. But again, you know, this concept is also there in the Katha Upanishad. So here I will end because, you know, we don't have that much of time. And I just want to say that, you know, I have provided the her theories and then the facts according to our texts. So this has been the whole flow of my presentation. So thank you everyone for listening to me. Jai Shri Krishna.
Namaste everyone. Thank you so much for joining us again post lunch. So in my current presentation, I will be speaking about the work of Michael Witzel. He is the Wales Professor of Sanskrit at the Department of Sanskrit and Indian Studies at the Harvard University. He is in fact only the fourth person to hold this chair since it was instituted in 1903. So now, Witzel is a very important Indologist whose work has spanned decades, and he's been the editor of very important series, including The Law of Code of Vishnu and so on. His repertoire has included him being the editor of some very important series as well. And the Aryan invasion slash migration issue has been one of his major theories. So I will be presenting some of his main points and refuting the same with archaeological and linguistic evidence. Witzel has also written a lot on Vedic Hinduism, so I will be considering some of his main points from there. Then, of course, there is this notorious petition he was a part of, where he prevented a few Hindu origin and Hindu Americans from taking control of the narrative that was printed about Hinduism in the grade 6th textbooks of the California public schools. So I discuss some of that as well, and then present my conclusions. So if we look at the main model of Witzel for his Aryan invasion slash migration, what he essentially believes is that a group of pastoral tribes from the steppes, who were already a part of an Aryan civilization, rode through the mountainous terrains of places like Iran, Afghanistan, and present-day northern India on horse chariots and arrived to terrorize the local population who then existed. Throughout this journey, apparently, they must have mixed with the local population and became racially intermingled over a few generations and finally reached modern North India. Perhaps one can think of it such huge collective amnesia that they seem not to have left a single trace of this entire arduous journey. Despite thundering through the journey, and thundering is a word Witzel uses, and having established themselves in the new place, they seem to have settled into the river-fed plains of the Indus Valley civilization and have neither named the new places, nor the rivers, nor left any geographical markers of the supposed homeland from which they have come. And then, in fact, he says that this entire process is based on intermingling of several orders and so much theorizations and convolution involved that even refuting any part of this becomes very difficult. And hence, this is a very convenient model, which has existed now for several decades. There have been several comprehensive rebuttals to Witzel's theory, including those by Vishal Agarwal, Kazanas, and S. Kalyanaraman. Now, Witzel's main model, it shares some of the features with others, including that of Romila Thapar, whose work was presented before lunch. And their main contention is that Sanskrit and Rigveda are not purely Indian in origin or as an IP. And that the ancestors of Bharata were invaders who migrated from outside, and hence an involute basis is laid for any future invasions and those becoming a part of the Bharatiya identity. There is, of course, also the relegation of Sanskrit sources, commentaries, and historical records of the traditional corpus. These have been relegated to secondary or sometimes even non-existent sources, so that only the and primacy has been accorded to that such as Iranian or Greek records, even when the quality of that evidence has been much more poor. And thus the Indian sources have been subject to a standard of quality control which has not been given to that of non-Indian sources. To understand more in detail about the states and what is involved, I would refer to the other paper. Now I consider particulars from Witzel's work. So if we consider even in 2019, so this is not some very old work, but even in 2019, when Witzel is writing in Beyond the Flight of the Falcon, he says, considering the term Uparisyena actually in Sanskrit means beyond the scope of eagle, and that is actually the designation of the Hindu Kush Mountains. Witzel uses something as innocuous as this word to read an arrow of direction of supposed migrants into India. No further explanation is offered, just this word. This is how he operates. Further, if we consider the archaeological evidence which is there, Witzel admits that the term Aryan is neither a racial one nor a linguistic one. This is important to realize because there is no such term as Aryan or Dravidian in the way that we use today in any of our traditional corpus. What he fails to mention, though, is that there is a whole colonial project behind these two terms, and this has been documented and studied by several people. He also, of course, even in 2019, he cherry-picks his data and omits the archaeological research, for instance, on the Saraswati Paleo channels, right, and what this impact has on the entire theory or even on the chronology of ancient India. Witzel gives 1300 BC as the period of the Rigveda, when in fact 1900 BCE would be the terminus antiquum for the Mahabharata itself. So Rig Veda being prior to that is not possible to be attributed to 1300. So even in 2019, WITSEL continues to ignore these hard evidences which have come from sciences such as hydrology, geology, geomorphology, and continues to peddle the previous migration slash invasion theories. For more details on these two, on the chronology of these, I would refer to my previous papers. The next contentious issues, and in fact one which has been flawed to death, if one can say, is that of the horse. Now, the main contention in this AI slash M theory is that the domesticated horse, as we know, and the Indo-European language, were introduced into India in the Indus Valley Civilization area by those who invaded and migrated from the supposed steppes. Now, this argument of the introduction of the horse is in fact crucial to Witzel's decades-old work and for others similar to Witzel, including Romila Thapa, because as Laurie Patton says in the Indo-Aryan controversy, if the horse is ever discovered to be contemporaneous with the Indus Valley culture or the pre-Vedic South Asian civilization, the migrationist theories would have to change dramatically. So despite knowing this, even in 2019, you have all these faunal remains which have been discovered. You have Mr. J.P. Joshi's of the Harappan site. He has discovered that. And when the findings of the Indian archaeologists were not trusted at the international platforms, they were further examined by the Hungarian archaeologist, Sandor Botroni, who confirmed that the remains that were discovered at the Harappan sites were that of the true horse itself. So this is not something which was in fact brought in as believed. We also have Sanjay Manjul's 2018 excavations at Sonauli, which have shown that chariots were unearthed dating to 2100 to 1900 BCE itself. So you have all of this in 2018, but you have Witzel continuing to peddle old theories and in fact even refusing to acknowledge that this wealth of evidence exists. Despite all this evidence that the proto-chariots were already there, Witzel believes them to have been imported into India by second millennium BCE. So this is the main section which concerned the archaeological evidence. Then there is the linguistic evidence and Witzel's refusal to engage with the domain's latest evidence. Now, we are aware of comparative linguistics and I'm not going to go deep into that. Comparative linguistics is when you consider the relationships and correspondences between two or more languages with the intention of trying to find a common ancestral language, right? So for instance, in the Indo-European case, they come up with the construct of the Indo-European because they believe it has to be a proto-Indo-European, which was brought into into the present-day Bharata territory from outsiders. So there is the hunt for this PIE. Now, this comparative linguistics in today's age has been shown to be a highly problematic field, which is riddled with circularity and a lot of fallacies. There are previous papers of mine to which one can refer for the details. But Witzel, on the other hand, believes that even though this is not a hard science, he accords primacy to the associations that one comes up with from comparative linguistics, more than that over any hard sciences like archaeology. So Witzel continues to believe that, you know, speakers of a proto-Indo-Iranian language, right, who lived apparently in the steppes or in Russia, they are the ones who finally came into present-day India and left behind loan words in their trail. Now, another question which we need to remember is, even if one were to admit or consider that, yes, there may have been some loan words, the question always comes down to, why should the arrow of direction always be into India? Why can't it be the other way? There is no such consideration as well. Now, in order to think that there should be some loan words and there should have been this linguistic evidence which can be considered as the basis, Witzel in fact studies a few of these, and the sad reality is that there is no such evidence. And when you have no evidence, the natural thing to do is to admit that the thesis itself with which you began is to be questioned. Instead, what Witzel does is that he sets aside that and continues to believe that it was the Iranians who simply changed some of their names in their local areas, and it is they who must have brought the same even into India. So he's refusing to even admit the evidence. Witzel also uses certain other vague material to believe that they are evidence, for instance, the Agnihotra ritual. Now, this Witzel introduces this as a sun spell and something which was done by the Iranians first, which is not really true. I mean, all cultures have elements of worship in the natural elements, but there is no one-on-one mapping between even the two of them. So Witzel does not admit that. Now, when he has not been able to find any evidences to back his theory, what Witzel has instead done is he has, in some cases, even invented the evidence. So this is a situation where Witzel mistranslated a verse from the Baudhayana Shrauta Sutra to make it appear that there was indeed a migration. So he has actually mistranslated a verse. When this was pointed out to him and by other senior scholars, including Konrad Elst, who pointed out that the manner in which Witzel had split the term to indicate that there was a migration was not actually the way in which it had to be done, he refused to acknowledge that. In fact, he went ahead to the point of saying that this is one of the few places where Elst may have been right. So there's a condescension. Instead of admitting that he has mistranslated it, he has just said, okay, you know, this is one of the strange occurrences when somebody else may have been right, and he continues to believe the same thing. Apart from this section, Witzel has also worked on a lot of texts, translating very important Sanskrit texts into English under his editorship, and in the process, he has written extensively on Vedic Hinduism. I am considering in my book particularly a few works, the one especially where he's written with Stephanie Jameson. Witzel and Jameson both date the Vedic period to 1500 to 500 BCE. And then again, the reason they have chosen this range is because their lower limit is directed by Beshert's influential work on dating the Gautama Buddha. Now, why is this problematic? Why is dating Buddha problematic? Is an entire chronological enterprise by the British as a very important colonial project. So which is beyond the scope of this theory, but the paper referred here has them. Further, Witzel, similar to Romila Thapar that we saw in the previous section, uses Vedic Hinduism as something which is very apparently different from what we call as Hinduism today. So they try to create this differences. They admit that there are, of course, many surprising continuities, but they do not want to look at any picture which shows an unbroken lineage or an unbroken tradition over the past 5,000 plus years. Witzel also believes that the Rig Veda, or at least the parts of it, may have been composed in the Avestan region. So again, this is what I was referring to earlier when I said the states involved with some of these theorizations is that the central corpus of the Hindu texts are not indigenous to us. That is one of the important consequences which comes out. Witzel also says that the approach of scholars and our gurus such as Adi Shankaracharya's on interpretation of the Upanishads was wrong from the point of view of the development of the Indian thought. And when pushed and challenged, he offers actually no explanation. His response is to not even consider the pushback which he has received. Witzel also makes a comparison between several practices which are core to Hindu texts, as I mentioned earlier, like for instance, the Agnihotra ritual. And he tries to draw parallels between them and Iranian words, while always using the Iranian words as the standards to which, even though they are actually a lot more poorly described and poorly retained, they are apparently the originals and what we have in India being something that is inherited. Another important feature of Witzel, which I'm sure even Bakshiji may touch upon, is the manner in which he rebuts or responds to those who challenge his work. For instance, V. Swaminathan, when he called out some of the translations and words of Witzel against Panini and Sayanacharya he was responded with extremely rude and abusive language, but nothing basic was considered. I will now come to the next section, which is Witzel's petition. So, the California public schools in the grade 6, they use different textbooks from different publishers, and Hindu origin parents as well as Americans with Hindu background noticed that their children were learning the following as some of the main texts of Hinduism which were being taught. That is, the Vedas describe Aryan victories during their invasion of India, which is factually incorrect. Then you have page 169 of the Holt Basic Reading Series, which claims that the Ramayana was written later than Mahabharata, which is again false. Then you have another book by the Hartrott School publishers, which claims that Hindi is written with the Arabic alphabet using 18 letters, when it's actually written with Devanagari. Similarly, they had other statements that the monkey king Hanuman loved Rama so much that it is said that he is present every time when Ramayana is told. So look around, do you see any monkeys? These were the kind of things which were being taught to grade 6 students in the California public schools. So you had the parents protest, and they applied to have some of this basic errors, you know, factual inconsistencies to be corrected, and they challenged the system. And what should have been a matter purely between, Indian Americans and Hindus whose heritage was at stake, and the California board, and you know, the interaction between the two. Instead, you have Witzel, who thundered into this picture, along with other scholars, and said that these changes should not be implemented. That is, corrections should not be carried out. So he led a group of 150 scholars. He says scholars, but in fact, some of them were people who were specializing in road transportation, and they had nothing to do with Hinduism or with the scholarly aspects of it. All of these people challenged the changing of the texts. Then you had the meeting in which CSB asked both the sides to present their matter, and this entire episode, I've given the details over here. So Witzel believed that murtis of Hindu gods should still be called statues. He objected to them being called even murtis. He said that, you know, when called out that Ramayana cannot be shown to have occurred later than Mahabharata, he goes on to say who in the sixth grade should care about these things. So he doesn't want any of the changes to be carried out. So I have documented this episode as well in the paper. And in the interest of time, I will now summarize the main points. So Witzel's work, many people have called out some of the inaccuracies and have provided very systematic rebuttals to him. In fact, there's one excellent one by Bhagwan Singh, who is the author of The Vedic Harappans, who has shown in how little Witzel actually knows about the material he claims expertise in. I think future work in studying Witzel's material should involve using Sanskrit non-translatable lens. And this is in fact something which should be used for the whole range of scholars, including Romila Thapar and so on, to see how, if one uses the lens of S&T, how all of their translations, how all of their interpretations would be absolutely wrong. So that is something which can be done further. Witzel's work also is there in mythology, which has very racist overtones, and that also needs to be studied. So if there are any questions, I'll take it after Bachiji has spoken, and I'll conclude my presentation now. Thank you.
Thank you, Manoogna. Now I would like to request Major General Bakshi, retired Indian Army veteran and author, to add his comments of the presentation of Manoogna and Anurag. So please.
Mr. Rajiv Malhotra, Mr. Kalyan Raman, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Today I have been forced to reflect on a very important but very little known facet of our own recent history. And I am very grateful to these two young scholars who have done a yeoman service in analyzing the works of Romila Thapar and Witzel. And they deserve a big hand, both of them. And you know, we did not transition from a colonial state to an independent state directly. There was an intergenum of dominion status. All right? The simple fact of history, and I'd like to go a little into a little known aspect of our history. You got free in 1947 only and only because the INA and Subhash Bose had completely subverted the loyalties of 25 lakh British Indian Army. Period. And if you want to substantiate that, just take a look at the transfer of power archives. How the history of the independence struggle could have been written without reference to the transfer of power archives is something that amazes me. But it has been done. You know, so the truth is that INA and Netaji got you freedom. But power was handed over to an Anglophile elite led by Nehru. And he appoints the first Governor General, Lord Louis Mountbatten. And then after 200 years, you gain independence. I thought we would be very keen to boot the British out. Get the hell away from us. Leave us in peace. But no, we had... Lord Louis Mountbatten anointed as the first Governor General. And as I keep saying, Pakistan had the decency to appoint Jinnah as their first Governor General, right? Now, from this Anglophile orientation of the successor colonial regime, we can today discern the outlines of a kind of a succession plot designed to see that the narratives and the histories and the concepts, you know, which had been propagated by the Raj continued. And to perpetuate or perpetuate these narratives, we had a set of intellectual coolies. You know, we had a set of so-called leftist liberal historians whose bounden mission was to see that not one word of the narratives propounded by the Raj were changed by any, now I don't want to get abusive, but any brown ass people later, right? Were not changed. And ladies and gentlemen, one of the doyens of this brigade of leftist liberal historians is Romila Thapar. Let me give you an inkling of her importance. When I attended the National Defense College course in New Delhi as a brigadier, you know, that is the highest seat of learning in the armed forces. One of the premier lectures used to be by Romila Thapar on the issue of caste. It was her duty to inculcate into the Indian senior military and a lot of police officers, intelligence officers, DRDO, many other allied organizations come there and attend that one-year-long course. You know, to sort of mold their minds into a narrative. You know, in the fashioning of a so-called secular state in India, there was a design. And, you know, behind one of the architect queens of this design is this Romila Thapar lady, right? And two anchor premises that she took from the British era or the colonial dispensation was one, that there was never, ever a state called India. It was a gift of the British Empire. They united you. They got you together. And, you know, there is that imperial justice theory which the British used to justify their rule in India. What was this imperial justice theory? The imperial justice theory said the Indians are such a fractious, squabbling, fighting lot amongst themselves, a cauldron of races, castes, creeds, languages, ethnicities, that they can never, you know, rule themselves. They can never operate freely. Any Indian who's selected will never be able to rise above his caste loyalties, sub-identities, to be able to have a pan-India view. And therefore, India needs foreign rule. If there is to be the rule of law and justice, and you know, the Mughals gave it to us first, and then the British came onto the scene to gift us, you know, nationhood, etc. You know, this kind of arrant nonsense. And then she went on, one of the prime, and I think it is a very nefarious role. I'm sorry. It is an extremely nefarious role to construct a so-called secular state in India. One of the primary planks was the, in a democratic dispensation, 80% of the country are Hindus. If you splinter them into a multiplicity of castes and creeds, then they lose their demographic relevance. They can never elect a government, you know, which is, let us say, pro-Hindu in ethos. They will never be able to do that. And this is actually what was done. The British use caste as the primary fault line. Risley is the architect of the caste fault lines in India. Because after 1857, the British were shaken. How could this disparate country of these competing cauldron of caste, creeds, races, etc., come together to, you know, launch a nationwide revolt against us? So they said, we'll see that it never happens again. So identify every fault line in the Indian body politic and make sure that you widen those cleavages. Right? And you know, we have that taunt by Churchill, you know, to talk of India as the basis of a nation state is as ridiculous as saying that the equator can be the basis of a nation state. The Madrasi, the Punjabi, the Tamil, the Maratha, the Assamese, what have they in common with one another? Nothing. We united them. You see, these are the narratives that a set of Indian intellectual coolies, as I think Rajiv very rightly calls them, I mean, it is disgraceful. And this breed was specifically created by the British, by Macaulay. Let me read out to you, you know, he says, you know, this British system of education, they severed the Indian educated classes from their cultural roots and reducing them to little more than mindless mimics of Western fashions and mores. There was a want of pride and want of faith in their own traditional culture and as the part of the upper classes of India. This sense of constitutional inferiority that seemed to have possessed the Indian. This is Benfield Havel, a Britisher writing on what he saw of the Indian intellectuals that had been created in the colonial period. So Romila Thapar et al. Are all inheritors of that Macaulay tradition which created clerks for the empire. Clerks for the empire. Mental coolies for the empire. And one of their tasks was to see that none of the British narratives were changed. So the concept of imperial justice was incorporated into the Indian constitution by calling it social justice. More than liberty, fraternity, equality. In a democratic constitution, our preamble begins with to give to ourselves justice, social. It is an echo hangover of imperial justice. Right? This was the job of Romila Thapar, which she did to excellence. She propounded the theory that there was no nation called India. There was never ever a nation called India. And I would like to remind her that every time any Hindu family sits down for any ritual, you start with an invocation of, you know, of Jambudvipe Bharat Khande. It is ages old, this affirmation. And she says, well, there was no nation state called India. There is no religion called Hinduism. Please, that is the next part of it. Because a secular state of the kind that they desired, you know, our mind, our view of secularism is that sarva dharma samabhava, all religions are equal. We give no preference to any particular religion. There is no state religion in India. But here was that for India to be secular, Hinduism has to be destroyed as a religion. We have to come to the first, you know, anchor premise that there was no country called India. Thanks to the British. You know, loyalty to the Raj has continued for 75 years after independence because of a series of intellectual coolies like Romila Thapar. Now, this lady has magisterial, airs. We were conducting a seminar in the Vivekananda International Foundation. It was, that whole seminar was conceived and led by the late Dr. B.B. Lal, the doyen of Indian archaeology. And he said, issue invitations to these people. So we told him, sir, inko kyun bula? He said, no. Issue invitations. We want them to come and discuss and debate. They refused. It is beneath their dignity to discuss with right-wing, you know, hawks or this or that or whatever you'd like to call it. The same thing, Rajiv Malhotra ji challenged her to a debate. Let's come and discuss. That is the academic methodology. Peer review. What you are writing must be peer reviewed by your fellow travelers in the academic field. But you refuse to discuss. You refuse to debate. You claim to be Democrats when you refuse the right to dissent. In this particular seminar, once again, they have all been invited. And you can ask Rajiv ji as to what kind of responses we have got, where we have got them. So what kind of a Democrat are you? What kind of an academic are you? If you are not prepared to discuss and debate your findings, your conclusions, that is the academic method. But she has trenchantly refused to do this. Another thing that she has tried to do as part of this secular entity creation project is very important. The trying to create a secular nation, you know, in the mold of the European nations. And the European nation, I mean, the American president swears on God, holds the Bible in his hand. And I mean, so is it for all the European nations, more or less. But in India, they wanted a kind of an anti-religion, anti-majority religion, by the way. One particular religion to be singled out, ye toh dharam hi nahi hai. There is no Hindu faith. There are so many of these, you know, sub-sects and this and that. There is no Hinduism, there is no India. And you are one of the prime doyen of historians in India. There is no India. You are a doyen of the historians of India. And one of the things that she, you know, pioneered, history must not call to memory the dastardly crimes and atrocities and genocides of Indians' past Islamic rulers, because such recollections give rise to unhealthy trends which militate against the secular fabric of this country. I think I have proved my case. You will not talk of the massacres. You will not talk of the destruction of temples. You will deny the destruction of temples. You will try and, you know, cream it over. Give it a very, very positive spin. These are not historians. These are spin doctors. These are not historians. These are spin doctors who have been spin doctoring the British narratives and trying to present them as the infallible truth. Long after the Raj is gone, the intellectual coolies of the Raj have stayed behind. The Macaulay brand of clerks have stayed behind. And Sushri Romila Thapar has impeccable credentials. Her grandfather presented a saropa to General Dyer of Jallianwala fame. I rest my case. You see, the whole family rose because of their loyalty to the Raj. And we can see this loyalty continuing. We can see this loyalty continuing. And though she writes in her magnum opus on the history of India, you know, that we must be open to new interpretations. And any new interpretation is Hindu, right? Is, you know, revanchist, is kind of anti-secular. The way she bristles that any other interpretation than what the British gave is what it is. And it was her prime duty to try and preserve the narratives of the Raj. The second part of this very same series is Michael Witzel. And the two of them have collaborated. You know, Romila Thapar is a doyen of ancient Indian history. Any gentleman, any good friend of mine who has passed the IAS, IPS exam has had to read Romila Thapar, Irfan Habib, R.S. Sharma. You see? And therefore, a number of my bureaucrat friends, today, when we talk to them, as to look, why don't we base our history on empirical facts? We are not talking of the saffronization of history, sir. We are saying kindly base it on empirical fact, logic, and so much evidence that has piled up in various scientific fields like radio, carbon, dating. Max Müller said the Vedas were written in 1200 BCE. Period. It's an edict, it is a fatwa, you dare not change. And the trenchant way in which the leftist liberal historians have held on to this fatwa is amazing. And I will just tell you that Birhana on the Saraswati banks has been carbon dated to 8500 BP in the upper layers, 9500 years ago in the lower layers. Which is more scientific? Which is more accurate? Max Müller fatwa, back of the envelope calculation, or this one? But yet, Romila Thapar and her ilk have held on to Max Müller. And they said, dare you deviate. So, one of the key historical debates in this country is about the strategic direction of the so-called Indo-Aryan migration, oblique invasion. Right? And Wetzel is one of the prime, you know, prime votaries of the Aryan invasion theory. Prime votaries of the Aryan invasion theory, you know, which was suggested, of course, by Maxwell, but then really souped up by Mortimer Wheeler, who accused Indra of genocide, of the slaughter of 100, you know, Dravidian cities. Now, no historical evidence has ever been adduced for this slaughter. Show us the corpses. They haven't been able to show that. But the strategic direction debate continues. My point is, the Saraswati River, the historicity of this has been disputed by all the leftist liberal historians and the colonial historians. And Romila Thapar would have us believe it was a dirty nala called the Hraksavati in Afghanistan, which came from some little pool somewhere and ended up in the dirt swamps. Ladies and gentlemen, the Landsat satellite images sent back in 1970s have first shown the trace of a mighty river from the Himalayas to the sea, 4,600 kilometers long, 6 to 8 kilometers wide, perhaps bigger than the Brahmaputra, which is the cradle of not just the Indo, the Aryan civilization in India, but I would reckon that it is the Ur-Haitmat, the Indo-European homeland that the European scholars talked of, right? And the fact is, you will say, but everybody says that people came from Central Asia, Anatolia, to India, because India is a more rich and productive and fertile land. Those are dry desert sands. So it makes sense, logic, a strategic east-west orientation of any mass movements, whether it is the Greeks, the Iranians, the Sakas, the Huns, you know, the Turco-Mongols, etc., etc., etc. It's all east to west. So why should there have been an out-of-India migration? Yes, it could have occurred in two circumstances. One is if there was an eco-catastrophe in northern India. And there was an eco-catastrophe when the Saraswati dried out, desiccated, and the whole area was desertified. What is Rajasthan today was so lush and green that there used to be rhinos there and tigers there, incidentally. So lush and green it was. It became a desert. Are you trying to tell me that mass migrations or invasions will take place into an area that has been desertified? What is more likely to happen? The people who are now thirsting for water will either migrate east towards Ganga, Yamuna, Doab, or they'll migrate westwards, Afghanistan, Iran, and out. And more evidence is piling up, and Kalyan Raman, there could be nobody better than him to talk on this, that the migration is out of India. Wetzel, you know, connived to see that Bodhayan Shrauta Sutra on the movement of Amavasu. Amavasu moved west is what the verse says. And it has been mistranslated and quoted by Romila Thapar courtesy Wetzel. Because she had to cite a Western source, right? That Amavasu moved east, and the second interpretation is he didn't move at all. He stayed where he was in Parshu, that is Persia, and in Gandhar, that is Afghanistan, and beyond. Whereas the verse, actual verse says he moved west. He moved west. And Mount Ararat is perhaps named after Amavasu. And let me just give you another thing. The so-called, you know, fixation of Wetzel with everything came from Iran. What we have come to, and we can present in my latest book, you can have a look at that, Beyond the Aryan Invasion Theory. The simple fact is that the Dasas are the Dahas of Iran. Daha means common peasant in Iran, right? And it is said that they were once together in the Aryan homeland, in the Saraswati. There was an ideological dispute about the nature of how to worship the fire. The Angiras rishis did the havan by pouring oblations into the fire, homa into the fire. They said anything into the fire pollutes the fire. Because of this ideological conflict, there was a physical conflict. And then the Dasharajan war, the Dwadasharajan war, all that takes place. Dwadash is earlier. And the Iranians are pushed out into Iran with the Dwadasharajan war. King Devodas attacks 100 fort cities in the Arjikya region, which is the lower foothills of the Himalayas, right? And the Iranians are pushed out because the Arjikya is the Soma growing area, which is the prize Homa. They, you know, the Iranians can't pronounce the S, so they pronounce it as H. Soma becomes Homa. Sapta Sindhu becomes Hapta Hindu, right? So they were pushed out. And they tried to come back with the Dasharajan war when Sudas was ruling the Saraswati tract, the Middle Kingdom. A lot of similarities echoes with China. China also had a Middle Kingdom, right? And they had six warring states. We've had our period of the warring states. And from here, the Iranians have been pushed out. The strategic direction is west to east. One, because of ecological catastrophe. Two, because of wars. The Dwadasharajan war followed by the Dasharajan war, right? So a whole lot of the crap that has been perpetuated by Romila Thapar and Michael Witzel doesn't stand scrutiny when put to the test of empirical facts, right? I would also like to point out that there is no nation called India, right? This is one of the greatest, you know, disservices done to India by any citizen of India. You know, there is the key characteristics of a nation state are temporal depth and persistence over time. And if there is any one single country that has this persistence over time, from the times of the Indus Saraswati civilization down till today, it is India. Right? You have terracotta figurines of women with bindi on the center of their foreheads, vermilion in the partings of their hair. You see it today. They have bangles up to their upper arms. You see it today in Gujarat and Rajasthan especially. There are figurines in the postures of yoga. You see yoga today, right? There are figurines in the postures of meditation. There is a dead skeleton in the posture of meditation, right? So yoga and meditation are the two key pillars of, I would say, Sanatan Hinduism, Sanatan Dharma. Have been there from Birhana onwards, 8,000, 9,000 years from today, right down till the present. So you have continuity over time and you have the temporal depth, right? India is a nation state and it will continue, so help us God, to be a nation state despite the likes of Romila Thapar, despite the shenanigans of Wetzels. Thank you so much. I once again compliment these two scholars.